More than a dozen people arrested yesterday, including a local reporter. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, Nick Swartzell was there. He'll tell us what he captured on video. Plus, what voters think of the Paycor Stadium lease deal. Is Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear eyeing a run for president? And what federal funding cuts will mean for Cincinnati Public Radio. Joining me now to kick off our Friday news review are WVXU reporter Nick Swartzell and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Nick and Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Nick, these arrests that I referred to, they happened after a protest yesterday. How did this protest start?
So this began as a vigil on the banks, kind of by the Sing the Queen City sign, the big pink sign that's right across from the Roebling Bridge. And it was a vigil for Imam Ayman Salamon, who was detained by ICE earlier this month after his asylum was revoked. There were speakers kind of advocating for Salamon's release. There were people kind of talking more generally about the Trump administration's immigration policy. And then after the vigil kind of wrapped up, dozens of folks began to march across the bridge.
And was that marching across the bridge, was that something protest organizers had planned?
It seems there was a separate group that organized the march. It was organized. There were people that had planned to march. There were people in vests and kind of marshaling it. But I don't believe that the people who organized the vigil were part of that organizing.
I see. Tell us what you saw. Did the protesters interact with people who were driving across the bridge? This is the Roebling Suspension Bridge, and it can get, I don't know, it's busy off and on during different times of the day. So what was that interaction like?
Yeah, so as people began to march south, going through that roundabout before you get to the bridge on the Cincinnati side, there were a couple folks in cars who shared their displeasure with the protesters. One man made some obscene gestures and kind of yelled at protesters and honked and indicated he was calling the police. He eventually left. Another vehicle tried to drive through the protesters. I witnessed the vehicle get really close and maybe make contact with a couple of the protesters, but they didn't seem to be injured too badly. The vehicle then just kept going. The marshals that were wearing kind of their vests and everything put themselves in front of this vehicle, trying to keep it away from the bulk of the marchers. The driver kept going. There were people kind of banging on the hood of the car saying like, "Hey, stop, please." At some point, the marchers moved over to the side and the car drove off.
So what did police do when they showed up?
So after folks got onto the bridge, everybody was on the southbound lane, and then there were cars kind of coming northbound, and that kind of happened without incident. About halfway across the bridge, Covington police and also some other law enforcement from Kentucky responded. They had the bridge blocked off. They told people to get on the sidewalk, the two walkways, and then pretty shortly after that, they began making arrests. They arrested one person who was kind of out in front. Then they arrested a reporter from City Beat, Madeline Fitting, and another photographer who I don't know the name of, and then proceeded to move into the crowd and start arresting people.
What did you see in terms of how people who were marching interacted with the police?
I saw some yelling, you know, kind of saying like, "Hey, you know, don't do this," or chanting some anti-police slogans. I didn't see any aggression toward the police. I did see people kind of resisting as they were being arrested. But I also saw people getting on the sidewalks and then being arrested on the sidewalks as well.
You had interactions with the police yourself. So you identified yourself as a reporter. You mentioned another reporter got arrested. I mean, how did the police react to this identification? In some of the video, I hear you saying to the police that the woman who was arrested, that she's a reporter, she's press. Was there a reaction to that?
Yeah, in general, that didn't fly with the officers. I showed my press badge and everything, and I'm of the strong belief that, you know, agents of the state should be witnessed when they're conducting their duties. That's part of our job as the press. And I told them at one point, like, I'm just trying to do my job here. I wasn't trying to be aggressive, but also stand firm. And I was told, we don't care. Get out of here. And that seemed to be the general response.
What did you see happen with these arrests, these other arrests?
There was non-lethal projectiles that were deployed pretty quickly, officers running with those. There were people who were tased, at least two or three. I did witness one officer on the sidewalk who had been arresting a man, and after they had him on the ground, and you could see his legs kind of like, you know, kind of flailing and his head on the ground, continue to kind of use his fists on that person. So it was a pretty aggressive response, I would say.
The protesters were arraigned today. What happened in court?
So we know from the Covington Police Department that they say 13 people were arrested. I counted there were maybe 15 who were arraigned. I'm trying to get clarity on that number. Most were charged with an array of misdemeanors, including disorderly conduct, but then also a felony charge of rioting in the first degree. That's a Class D felony in Kentucky, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. They were given $2,500 cash bonds and were told not to go on the bridge.
Well, Chris, I want to move to you. Let's talk about Hamilton County's stadium deal with the Bengals. Was there much public comment about the deal during yesterday's commission meeting?
There was a little bit. There were about eight people who showed up to speak. They were all, except for one, in favor of the new lease terms that the county commissioners have so far approved. Certainly not maybe as many as you would expect. There were way more letters that people submitted online.
And we have, we're going to hear now from Mark Thomas.
You know, as a lifelong resident of Hamilton County, we need the Bengals in Hamilton County. We need Hamilton County as a whole. I feel the team brings a lot to the county.
Was that kind of support kind of a lot like what you heard from other people who were there?
Yeah, it was pretty, you know, it was pretty packed towards Bengals fans in person yesterday. Like I said, about, I think there were about eight people there. They had way more than that online. They had about 90 people with, you know, the majority being against the deal. The county's tally is 48 people responded against the deal and 40 people were either in favor of it or, you know, they didn't express opposition to it.
Well, let's hear now from Kent Evans.
I'm not a fan of the Bengals. I have another NFL team I favor. So I understand the fandom part. But this is a bad, bad deal.
So he was one of the few people there, I guess, who spoke yesterday against the deal. Remind us briefly, Chris, of the financial terms of the deal.
Yeah, what the plan is at this point is for the county to spend $350 million renovating the Paycor Stadium. The team will kick in $120 million for a total package of about $470 million. There is still hope that the state of Ohio could contribute some money. Originally, this renovation plan was about $830 million. So they have cut it down quite a bit just to only have the sources from the county and the team itself.
Well, I know Commissioner Alicia Reese remains skeptical.
We got to pay attention because the last group did not pay attention to the fine print and the taxpayers got ticked. They felt they got duped.
What are the other commissioners saying, Chris?
They are saying that this is a good deal. It's a better deal than what the county signed back in the late 1990s because the Bengals are putting in money, more money this time than they did last time. And the county is paying a lesser percentage of the overall total. The county's paying about three-fourths of the cost, whereas in the 1990s, it paid, my calculation is 93% there. We could go chapter and verse as to why the Bengals think that's not an accurate number, but you know, the percentage of the public paying for the original deal is extremely high, and it is a little bit less so in this current deal. And so the other two commissioners, Commissioner Denise Driehaus and Commissioner Stephanie Sumrow Dumas, think that they have struck a deal that is fair for the taxpayers.
How many more public hearings will county commissioners have on this deal, Chris?
I haven't heard of any. However, there is a county commission meeting every week. In fact, sometimes there's two. Often there's two. And the public is entitled to come and sign up and talk about the Bengals lease or any other topic that they might want to talk about anytime. We do know they are working towards July 31st deadline to really get the fine print, which is what Commissioner Reese wants to see settled. And at that point, they will have a final vote. There was really no update yesterday about whether they think they're going to make that deadline. It's probably one that can be moved a little bit if the lawyers are still hashing it out. But we didn't really get a good, solid update on that yesterday.
Chris, let's move from county government to city government, or let's talk about P.G. Sittenfeld. What is he seeking from the U.S. Supreme Court?
So former Councilman Sittenfeld, who was pardoned by President Trump on his federal public corruption convictions, he still wants the U.S. Supreme Court to review his case anyway. He wants it basically overturned from the Supreme Court. And so he and his lawyers have filed a petition before the court to ask them to do that.
And you referenced his corruption charges. Can you remind us again, just briefly, a little bit more about the details of what he was convicted of?
Yeah, in 2022, a jury convicted him of one count of bribery and one count of attempted extortion. This was all in connection to P.G. Sittenfeld accepting $20,000 in campaign contributions from undercover FBI agents who were posing as developers. And what they wanted was to exchange those campaign contributions for his support on a development project planned for what was known as the Convention Place Mall. It was kind of right. It was kitty corner from the convention center on Elm Street. It has since been demolished. You won't see that building there anymore if you drove by. So he was convicted on those two charges, and he served about 4.5 months of his sentence in Kentucky before he was released pending appeal by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2024.
And you mentioned he got a presidential pardon, but he says he didn't even ask for that, right?
There's still a little bit of a mystery. We've talked about this before. He said he was very surprised to have that, but President Trump did pardon him earlier this year.
I know his lawyers have been planning to ask the Supreme Court to review the case after it seems like appeals court judges practically encouraged them to do that. But now that he's been pardoned, why would they need the court to review the case at this point?
Well, I mean, he basically wants his record wiped clean. The argument is that he still had to pay a $40,000 fine. It was interesting in the filing they brought up that in the city of Cincinnati's view, he still owes his salary for when he was suspended from counsel pending his trial. And so there are remaining punishments that he has endured that he wants the court to wipe out. But really at the core of this is that Sittenfeld believes that he was wrongly prosecuted, and he wants the Supreme Court to basically affirm that view.
Are there bigger issues that P.G. Sittenfeld says are at stake in this whole thing?
Yeah, basically, he's making the argument that the campaign contributions that he accepted were lawful, and that they were campaign contributions between people who shared the same policy objectives, and that the prosecutors blew that up into bribery, and he argues that it wasn't bribery. And you know, the larger issue, he says, is that it will have a chilling effect on people who, you know, might go into politics or might decide to exit politics because of what he views as criminalization of conduct that was perfectly legal.
And do you have a sense, as I understand it, the Supreme Court hasn't said whether or not they will take this case. Do you have a sense for the kind of arguments that his lawyers would make to the court if the court does agree to review the case?
Not sure really beyond, kind of what we already talked about. they are going to, I guess they, it is important to say that they're going to argue that the Trump pardon doesn't make the matter, you know, go away. It makes it moot because his conviction is, you know, still out there, I guess. And so, you know, I think that's part of what they'll say. This is a really interesting case because even Sittenfeld has said in their research, they can't find a case that the court has taken where someone has already been pardoned as a result. The other noteworthy thing, and he said this previously, not in this filing, but that, you know, most of the people who are pardoned have admitted their guilt and apologized. And in this case, of course, he has not. So that's another kind of wrinkle here.
Interesting. And I know it's difficult to predict what the U.S. Supreme Court will or will not do, but do you have any feel for the time frame when we might know if they're going to take this case?
I don't really. You know, these things can take quite a bit longer than you would ever think they would take. Unsure. And, you know, I will say that the court has been rolling back kind of public corruption laws over the years, kind of tightening what they can be used for. The governor of Virginia, for example, was a prominent case in which they tossed out his conviction. There are other examples like that. So it is a topic that the court has been interested in. So I would not be surprised if they take it, even though there is, you know, this pardon that basically he has been, you know, let out of, you know, going to prison and all of that. So it won't surprise me if they do take it, but it also won't surprise anyone if they don't.
Sure. Well, I know you'll continue to follow that. I've been talking with WVXU reporter Nick Swartzel. Nick, thanks so much for being with us after your wild night and for giving us your eyewitness experience to last night's protests and arrests.
Yeah, thanks, Lucy.
And I've also been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks so much for your time, Chris. We always appreciate your reporting.
Thanks, Lucy. We'll see you later.
Up next is Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear laying the groundwork for a presidential campaign. We'll hear from a reporter who's been following what he's doing. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear was rumored to be a potential vice presidential pick for Kamala Harris. He didn't get tapped for that job. Is he considering a run for president himself? Joining me now to talk about that and other Kentucky news is Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Always happy to be here.
Well, it's always great to have you. Let's talk about Governor Beshear. There's been lots of speculation about whether he'll run for president, and he spoke at an AFL-CIO convention this week.
See, I believe that Donald Trump is our current president because he was able to convince that last group of undecided voters that he was less focused on culture war issues and more focused on costs and inflation. So I don't believe that was fair, and it's certainly not what he's doing now. Instead, we get chaos, incompetence, and cruelty.
So, Sylvia, why was Governor Beshear in South Carolina? That is, coincidentally, an early presidential primary state.
Yes, coincidentally, I'm sure. He says he was there because he was invited to speak at that convention. He had a couple other speaker invites he went to. And he also said his son's baseball tournament was at the end of the week. But you have to also, again, remember, it's an early primary state. We saw other, people whose names have been floated as a presidential potential for 2028 also go to South Carolina, including Governor Gavin Newsom of California. So it's you can't ignore that context. Definitely.
Oh, and I bet Governor Newsom didn't even have a son playing baseball in South Carolina. So what's Governor Beshear's overarching message to Democrats?
So it's not necessarily a new message for him. In fact, some of his speeches read similar to a op-ed he wrote in the New York Times a few months ago. But he basically was saying that Democrats need to try to convince that middle group of voters that went for Donald Trump that they are the party of kitchen table issues, that they're the ones who care about lowering costs and making, you know, America more affordable and making sure people have health care and all of these other things, and not focusing so much on, he used the phrase at least a couple times, or advocacy speak, focusing less on issue, culture war issues, and you know, kind of running to the middle.
Does he think his success as a Democrat in Kentucky can be replicated in other red Southern states?
So he definitely did talk about that a little bit. You know, he said he's living, breathing proof that Democrats can win in the South on the, you know, a statewide level. And it's true. I mean, he won by 5 points over Daniel Cameron in 2023. He significantly improved his margins when he ran for his second term. And Daniel Cameron was endorsed by Donald Trump, in fact, endorsed really early by Donald Trump. So, you know, that's he talked a lot about that he's this proof that there's a Democratic message that works in red states. But, you know, there's also worth noting that Beshear has quite the, you know, he has a background in Kentucky that gives him a little bit of advantage. His dad was governor before him. He was attorney general before that. And he also was running the first time against a really unpopular Republican incumbent. So, you know, it's also worth noting his success has yet to be replicated among Kentucky Democrats. You know, Democrats have not been able to win offices at the state level other than Beshear. And, you know, his success is also not replicated in state legislative races for Democrats. So all of that to say that you kind of have to take a little bit of grain of salt, but he is saying, like, this has worked for me in Kentucky. He thinks it can work for Democrats elsewhere.
Has he been raising money for out-of-state races?
Yeah, he's been doing that for, you know, about a year now. He has a couple of different groups. He has his 501c4, which is like one of these social welfare tax-exempt groups called Heckbent. We don't 100% know what that group has been doing. They haven't filed with the IRS yet. And he also has a super PAC, you know, that's one of those dark money groups called In This Together. That's raised a few million dollars. And while that's also gone to fund a lot of stuff in Kentucky, you know, for example, against our constitutional amendment for school choice that failed, that PAC has also spent some money on out-of-state races, especially some gubernatorial races for Democrats.
What has he said himself about running for president?
He has very much left the door open. He certainly hasn't promised he's going to run. That would be kind of crazy to do 3 years out from the race. But he says that, quote, if he can heal the country, he would run, that he would at least consider running if he felt like he was the person to heal political divides. But he also said that he wouldn't put his own career first if he felt he wasn't the right person to do that. So, you know, he's leaving himself a few different options here, but he certainly is not closing the door.
That certainly sounds about like the way he talks about politics generally, and he's so well known in Kentucky for his, you know, nightly chats during the COVID pandemic. You know, you saw all those memes of him like as Kentucky's Mr. Rogers kind of thing going on, and that's his energy. But have you heard from anybody, any commentators or observers? Does that kind of energy translate to a presidential race? I mean, in recent years, you know, we've had Donald Trump, who's this big personality and with this, you know, kind of attack dog energy for his enemies. And that doesn't seem to be Governor Beshear's vibe. Do people think that could translate to the presidential stage?
Well, that's definitely the question here, right? You know, the Democrats are at a bit of a, you know, fork in the road here right now. Do they go to try to court these, you know, quote unquote, middle of the road voters, the undecided voters? Do they try to court those people with someone like Beshear, you know, someone like Joe Biden, more traditional liberals who aren't trying to alienate anybody? Or do they go the more progressive route? Someone like a very controversial figure like Mamdani, you know, who goes for a much more progressive picture and doesn't shy away from that. And it might excite some voters and really turn off some others. So I think that Beshear, he's really betting on that middle of the road way that he's also done in Kentucky. He has this phrase that he says all the time. He said it a bunch in South Carolina. He said it a bunch during his gubernatorial race in 2023. I'm not trying to take the state left or right. I'm trying to take it forward. He says that all the time. And so I think that is really his political message. And I think it just is a question of what is the Democratic Party interested in right now? You're right. Beshear has not made himself an attack dog, at least not in Kentucky. You know, he kind of displayed that a little bit during that vice presidential I don't want to call that a race, but when they were when they're vying a little bit for vice presidents for vice presidential candidacy, you know, he went and made some media appearances where he did a little bit more aggressive talking. And I don't, you know, pundits are mixed on how successful that was for him. Obviously, he did not get picked for a position, you know, for as Kamala Harris's running mate. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, again, we're 3 years out. Who knows what the party will look like then?
Sure. Well, you've also been following the case of these women from Louisville who sued over Kentucky's near-total abortion ban. Remind us what the argument is in that lawsuit.
Right. So this is a kind of complicated and perhaps a little bit unexpected route to challenging the state's abortion ban. Essentially, the argument is in two buckets. These three Jewish women in Louisville are arguing that they feel their right to get or their ability to get IVF, in vitro fertilization. Yeah. Thank you. In vitro fertilization procedures has been hindered, and they're not sure if they're allowed to legally get that procedure under Kentucky's laws, that they're too vague and unclear if they're even allowed to do that and what they're allowed to do for their own fertility treatments. And then they also say that the law itself violates their religious freedom, that the idea that you should define what life is and specifically when life begins, they're using an inherently Christian definition, and it violates their rights as Jewish women who have a different definition religiously.
What's been happening with this case? What did the lower court rule on this?
Yeah, so the lower court ruled a while back that the three women, they didn't have standing. They decided that, and that's been kind of a common thing that's happened here a few times for challenges of the state's abortion ban, is that they said these women don't have an immediate threat from the ban and therefore cannot sue over it. However, this latest update was from the appeals court, the Kentucky Court of Appeals. They reversed that decision in part. They ruled that one of the three Jewish women does have the right to continue. And that is because she currently has frozen embryos. She has, I believe it's something like 9 embryos currently frozen, fertilized. And she already has canceled one appointment for fear that she would be run afoul of this law should she proceed. So the courts ruled that she does have the right to continue, but that the other two women do not have standing.
So these rulings have been all about whether they have the right to you know, make this case. Has any court ruled on the merits of their argument?
No, there's been no ruling on merits of these women's argument. Now, there was like a little bit of discussion by the lower court, but certainly nothing. But he made it very clear that this was just about standing. And, you know, that's been the case for a lot of different cases in Kentucky here, that we have not had any discussion of the merits of arguments against the state's abortion ban because standing has been such a difficult barrier.
Remind us, what is the state law in Kentucky when it comes to abortion access?
Well, there are a few. The Attorney General decided when Roe v. Wade was overturned that one law would be the supreme one, that this is the most recent trigger law that we're going to be implementing here in Kentucky. And it basically says that abortion is not allowed in any circumstance unless it's to save the life of a mother if she's in imminent danger. There was actually another law passed this year in Kentucky that went effect right away that also tried to specify more what that means, what it means for the life of the mother. It added a few more specifications, for example, like molar pregnancies would not be included, you know, would not be included under the abortion ban. It also, you know, had a little bit extra language about what it meant to be to save the mother's life. But by and large, that is the only exception to the state's abortion ban.
And you said these women who have been trying to sue that they believe it could that all applies to in vitro fertilization because of the ambiguity that they say exists in the laws. Is that kind of at the root of their case?
Yeah, so there's several different laws because the legislature had passed a lot of different things, you know, under a Democratic legislature and then under as a Republican legislature, different trigger laws. They say that it's too confusing, that it's unclear. I mean, we have various definitions of what it is to, you know, an unborn child is just in Kentucky statute. You know, some statutes say it's in vitro, in utero, that counts. Sorry, in utero counts as, when life begins. Some say it's at conception. Some say it's at fertilization. So there's lots of different, definitions. And some of them, you know, they didn't repeal a lot of the old ones. So, they're arguing that it's unclear. So, for example, you know, some people have cited a part of a fetal homicide law that was passed a long time ago that has an exception for fertility treatments, you know, that for, you know, embryos that are lost during a fertility treatment. However, that same statute also includes an exception to the fetal homicide for abortion. And obviously, abortion is not considered legal in this state. So it's their argument is that it is confusing, that there are too many, that the legislature needs to go back. The courts need to void all of these laws, and the legislature needs to go back and come up with something that is cohesive and understandable.
What has Kentucky's attorney general said about all this?
Well, the attorney general has said unequivocally that Kentucky statutes do protect IVF, that he does not believe that there's any ambiguity here and that, the courts don't need to weigh in on this because he believes that IVF is protected.
Okay. But does the state, is there a state law that spells out very explicitly whether IVF and fertility treatments are protected?
No. There is not. And a Democrat and a Republican actually filed legislation. This was after that Alabama court decision that sent a lot of IVF clinics into kind of a panic. And so some Kentucky state legislators, I believe in 2024, did file legislation, but none of it got picked up. And again, lawmakers, if you ask them, will say, well, they don't think it's an issue, that, you know, no court in Kentucky, at least, has ruled that IVF is in danger and therefore, and no one's been prosecuted, so you don't have to worry about it.
Well, another lawsuit against the state relates to gender-affirming care. Walk us through that lawsuit.
Right. So this lawsuit was brought by the ACLU, and basically what it says is that a new state law that went into effect in June, basically it bans the use of gender-affirming hormone therapies or surgeries in state prisons or jails. And essentially what the ACLU is arguing is that that is a violation of people's rights, and that is a violation of the Constitution, constitutional provision against cruel and unusual punishments.
And I understand there's a named plaintiff. I think it's Madeline Markham, right? Why is Madeline Markham incarcerated?
Well, Madeline is incarcerated on a charge of murder. I mean, a conviction of murder, should say. And she has been in imprisoned for quite some time now and has been on hormone therapy for quite some time as well. She was diagnosed with gender dysphoria before her imprisonment, quite a while before. She was on hormone therapy before her imprisonment. And so she was able to, after a bit of a gap in between, was able to restart that therapy, that treatment. And, her argument is that her doctors say that it's medically necessary that she continue this treatment and that it's not up to the legislature what is medically necessary and what is not.
And when someone is incarcerated like that, getting medical treatment, is that the state that's paying for that medical care? Is that part of the issue here?
Yeah, that's what they're arguing, that they don't want state funds. They don't want any funds, from the taxpayer to pay for gender-affirming care and treatment. You know, it's also worth noting that at the same time as they passed this, the state legislature also passed a ban on Medicaid dollars paying for any of these treatments as well. So, you know, it's kind of part of the theme here that they don't believe it's medically necessary and they don't believe that the taxpayer should pay for it.
Hmm. And the state stopped providing this care because of this law that was passed, you said.
They have stopped or they are stopping. So there is like a little provision in this ban that allows doctors to cycle people off medication.
Okay.
It doesn't have a specific time frame of how long that should take, but it does allow them to continue for some period of time to allow someone to cycle off to avoid any complications, because there can be complications from immediately stopping a hormone therapy treatment.
Sure. Is the lawsuit seeking some kind of immediate action from the court because of those complications that can arise?
Yes, I believe they're seeking a temporary, an initial injunction. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if they asked for a temporary restraining order, although they very well may have. I think that they did ask for that restraining order, and those can happen pretty quickly, a TRO. But I don't believe that, you know, we have an exact timeline of when we can expect that.
Do you have any idea what kind of chance the ACLU might have in a case like this? And I ask because this issue came up as a big talking point in the presidential race. It was used against Kamala Harris in attack ads. I mean, do you have any thoughts on whether a lawsuit like this could succeed in Kentucky?
It's a really hard thing to say. Now, to be fair, you know, we say in Kentucky, this was filed in federal court.
Okay.
So this is, you know, a constitutional argument. And the ACLU at least says that they are very confident that you can't single out, make a universal ban on a specific type of healthcare that's prescribed by doctors. Now, whether or not that pans out is, of course, the question. Whether or not, you know, the courts have changed. Obviously, you know, we're seeing a lot of changes in the courts, you know, overruling of president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't say for sure, you know, what kind of chances they have, but, you know, I'll be closely watching and we'll just have to wait and see if this new law will be able to stand muster.
Yeah. And this is, you mentioned federal court. Which federal court is this?
This is the Eastern District of Kentucky. And I'm trying to remember, I think it's based out of Lexington, but I would need to double check that.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you so much for your time today, Sylvia. It's always great to talk with you.
Always great to be here.
And we're going to go to our next segment, but first I want to let you know we have a hiking show coming up next Thursday. It'll be for the full hour. Please tune in. We want to hear from you about your favorite places to hike, where you like to go, what you recommend, and we'll have hiking experts on to offer tips. So mark your calendars. Next Thursday is the day for our hiking show, and you won't want to miss it. Up next, we're going to discuss what federal funding cuts could mean for Cincinnati Public Radio. We'll have our Cincinnati Public Radio president, CEO, and general manager on to answer questions, and you won't want to miss that either. I know many of you have been following this vote in Washington, D.C. very closely, as we have too, and we're going to hear from Rich Eisworth about the impact that those cuts could have on us here at Cincinnati Public Radio. So stay tuned. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
On this vote, the yeas are 216. The nays are 213. The resolution is adopted.
By a narrow vote, the House clawed back federal funding for foreign aid and public media. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me to explain what these cuts will mean for public radio here in Cincinnati is Cincinnati Public Radio President Rich Eisworth. Thanks for being here, Rich.
My pleasure. I wish it would be for a happier reason.
Yes. Well, in a note, per NPR standards, Rich has not reviewed the questions I'm going to ask him ahead of time. Rich, you know, some members of Congress spoke in favor of these cuts. Here's Republican Eric Schmidt of Missouri.
We don't have to sit by anymore and continue to send the hard-earned tax dollars that are sent here by the guys that swing the hammer and the gals who drive the trucks back in Missouri, who should be mortified that they're spending money for the head of NPR to call the president a bigot, a racist. Enough is enough.
And other lawmakers spoke in favor of preserving funding for public radio. Here's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska.
I come from a state that is extraordinarily rural. I come from a state where access to other forms of information and communication may be limited. It may be everything may just come by way of your radio.
Rich, I know you've been following all this very closely. What did you make of this debate over the past few days?
It's typical for the debate we've heard for the past few weeks of months and maybe even going back to 1967 for years. There clearly are people on both sides of the aisle who have a clear understanding of the value of federal support for non-commercial broadcasting. On the other hand, there is, I'm happy to say, a minority, but a vocal minority who harbor misconceptions, misinformation, disinformation, whatever you want to call it, about what public broadcasting truly is and what service we provide to the American people and how much that service is valued by the American people.
So, Rich, how big a hit is this for Cincinnati Public Radio?
To be honest, the totality of that impact is yet to be determined. CPB provides on average about 5 to 6% of our cash budget every year, which is anywhere between $400,000 and $500,000. Now, over and above that, though, CPB provides in-kind support for other services that we rely on. For instance, our satellite interconnection that allows us to get programming from NPR, the CBC, BBC, American Public Media, and other stations across the country. CPB also provides the funding to cover music licensing from music license organizations such as ASCAP and BMI that provides us the flexibility and the freedom to program music on all of our stations. We don't know yet what that the impact of that elimination will be.
That could be a big one, the music
licensing.
It could
be, not only in terms of cash, but also in terms of the time that's required for us and hundreds of stations across the country to individually negotiate with these licensing organizations.
There were failed attempts to amend this bill and preserve funding for public radio. Did those attempts give you any hope for the potential of future funding?
There's always hope. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this business. I will tell you, under the current administration, considering that the extreme efforts that they went through to claw back funding out of already appropriated and approved by bipartisan houses and both houses of Congress, I think it's exceptionally unlikely that we're likely to get approval for or support for future funding. As I said, at least while the current administration is in power.
Do you have any idea yet what cuts you'll have to make here because of this loss of funding? I know you said the size of the hit is yet to be determined. Are there programs that might have to be cut, like this one that you're talking to right now?
Depends on how nice you treat me.
Well,
no, I'm sorry to be
bad
flipped.
News. Yeah,
it's very premature. We are going to be meeting as a management team and then working very closely with the finance committee of our board of directors. We have some ideas, but we're going to do first everything we can to maintain first and foremost the service that we provide to the public, which is the programs we obtain from national and international sources, as well as our award-winning local productions, such as Cincinnati Edition. And then over and above that, after that, we will do everything we can, recognizing the value of our staff to protect and maintain the current staffing levels.
So you don't think you'll have to cut staff?
I'm not saying that, and I don't mean to be the death knell here or, ominous, but everything's on the table right now. We don't, as I said, know the full impact of these reductions, and we will do everything, as I said, to protect what we've got.
There's been some talk about some of this funding being restored, but on a shorter leash. Here's what NPR CEO Catherine Marr said about the vote this morning.
We're already in conversation about the FY26 fiscal process which is ongoing right now. I think the thing to understand is that many of our stations are already in that budget year. That budget year started for them at the beginning of this month. It will begin for others at the beginning of October, which is the federal fiscal year. So we are talking about stations that are expecting to receive those funds imminently from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we have been told by colleagues at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that they could be bankrupt by the beginning of October.
Now, we are one of those stations whose fiscal year started July 1st. So what does it mean to have this funding pulled after the fiscal year has already begun?
What's the phrase, getting the rug pulled out from under you? I will say, as devastating and as frightening as these cuts are, we have been very fortunate with leadership from our board of directors and the excellent management team we have here to budget traditionally very conservatively. So this budget for this fiscal year, we conservatively budgeted for expenditures and did likewise even more so with what we project for revenue. So we're cautiously optimistic we'll be able to weather the storm, at least in the short term. And by that, I mean at least for the remainder of this fiscal year through next June 30.
You know, we're sitting in our beautiful new space here in Evanston, this new facility we opened just a few months ago. I think there might be some of our listeners who think, well, gosh, they had all that money to build that new building. They don't need us. Can you explain how that works?
We're still fundraising for that beautiful new building. It is important to note that no federal money was harmed in the construction of this building. This building was funded and has been funded exclusively, almost exclusively, by local philanthropies, foundations, and individuals. We did get a one-time grant of $145,000 from the state of Ohio for capital projects related to the building. And I think that also, it's an important point I want to mention, that unlike what we saw at the federal level, we are very fortunate in the state of Ohio that we have a long history continuing into the present of bipartisan, strong bipartisan support, not only in the legislature, but also in the governor's office. So we're very hopeful and expect that support will continue regardless of what happens on the national scene.
You kind of referenced this administration earlier, but given this vote, this administration, do you think it'd be wise for our station to just try to avoid funding from the federal government for the foreseeable future?
I think it would be wise for us to not assume that that will be a reliable source of income for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Public Radio President Rich Eisworth. Thanks so much for your time today, Rich. I know it's a busy day for you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you and your staff does.
Thank you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.